May it please the Court. Mr. Greer. This case demonstrates that the cover-up is often as serious, if not more serious, than the initial misconduct. Lawyers who violate the ethical standards for competently and diligently representing their clients may, in some instances, be rehabilitated so that the public and the integrity of the bar are protected. On the other hand, lawyers who attempt to cover up their misdeeds through concealment and fraud lack the necessary character and fitness to practice law. Respondent in this case has an extensive disciplinary history combined with multiple instances of misconduct involving the representation of two clients, culminating in an attempt to conceal his neglect by creating a fraudulent paper trail. The disciplinary history is extensive and noteworthy. After defaulting on the prior information, the court set aside the default disbarment on July 29, 2008. Thereafter, the disciplinary hearing panel issued respondent four admonitions for law practice management violations. At about the same time, respondent also entered into a diversion agreement with the OCDC, which he later violated and for which he was again admonished. Finally, in 2011, respondent overdrafted his trust account and was admonished for failing to maintain required client records.
This isn't directly relevant, but we generally, in the last 10 years, have a progressive discipline system. Why were so many admonitions given as opposed to moving to a reprimand at some point after a certain number of admonitions? Normally, discipline is increased to a higher level.
Yes, you're right, Judge Stith. In this case, I believe it was because the four group admonitions the panel issued were all law practice management, 1.3, 1.4 type issues. The diversion agreement violation had to do with failing to get malpractice insurance, so we felt that that was an unrelated type of violation of the diversion agreement. The trust account violation ended up being just not having client ledgers, documentation necessary to help us figure out what was going on. So while I absolutely agree that we follow a system of progressive discipline, in this case, as sometimes happens on a case-by-case basis, he ended up with six admonitions when probably he could have been brought up sooner to the court.
Seeing all these problems, where our goal is to protect the public, to see all these problems, giving progressive discipline might have been helpful to the public, that he didn't hurt anyone else in the public.
No doubt, and as we see in this case, the culmination is in this case when he represents two clients, Ms. Mara and Ms. Gorodziewski, abandons Ms. Gorodziewski, and in the case of Ms. Mara, totally neglects the matter and engages in a serious conflict.
It's also for the benefit of the attorney, so if an admonition doesn't get their attention, we want to catch things early on, and a reprimand might make someone take their responsibility.
Yes, no doubt. I mean, as I said, I think in this case, just the way it progressed,
we probably went beyond
where we should have gone in terms of admonishing instead of bringing the respondent back up to the court.
Should be a suspension or disbarment? What should be, suspension or disbarment?
In this case?
Yes.
In this case, the panel recommended disbarment largely based on the fact that the respondent attempted to cover up his lack of communication with Ms. Mara in the case with the contractor by submitting in the legal malpractice case six letters which counsel for Ms. Mara determined or believed were fraudulently produced after the fact.
Did your change in recommendation is based on accepting the finding of the DHP that it was fraudulent? Because reading it appears that you requested a lesser discipline because you really weren't sure if it was.
We weren't sure, and we largely based it on ABA standard 6.11 versus 6.12. The panel ended up finding intentional falsification of these documents to mislead the court in the legal malpractice case. We thought it was knowing misconduct, which calls for a suspension versus a disbarment. However, we totally agree, based on as the evidence progressed and came out during the hearing, we agree with the panel's finding that this was a fraudulent cover-up of a lack of communication by the respondent in the legal malpractice case. What ends up happening, first of all, is Ms. Mara ends up in a dispute with a contractor for some storm damage that she had. The contractor is hired by the insurance company's adjuster, And then when the contractor seeks to collect on the balance owed for what turned out to be a shoddy job of work on the house, the contractor sues Ms. Mara, and the insurance adjuster hires the respondent to represent Ms. Mara in the case against the contractor, who the adjuster also hired. The respondent admitted at the hearing that this was a conflict. In our view, it was a conflict that, frankly, was not waivable. He didn't seek to get a waiver from Ms. Mara. In fact, he never contacted Ms. Mara. She never had a choice of counsel. She never signed a representation agreement. And when
of course, he says he did, if we believe the letters, contact Ms. Mara.
If you believe that he sent those six letters, then there's right. a level of communication that the
but
panel
never,
did not
never
believe.
Never a contractor, a hiring.
By the way, it's relevant in our view that he did admit to a lack of communication with Ms. Mara, which to us seems to indicate that why admit to a lack of communication and then produce six letters periodically during this litigation that tends to show a level of communication that probably didn't violate 4-1.4. So that's one element that to us seems to corroborate the fact that these letters were fabricated. The other elements that seem to corroborate that is that the letters contain conflicts in terms of the events and dates described versus the actual dates in the court's docket. A respondent in his letters to Ms. Mara references that he was in court on dates when the court record says he was absent. The letters suggest that respondent is in court on dates when the court isn't even in session. The letters suggest a future court date when no such court date even existed if you check the court's record. And this is all testified to, by the way, at the hearing by Gina Chiala, who was Ms. Mara's attorney in the legal malpractice case. One letter says that Ms. Mara needs to be present at a future call docket, and the panel correctly found, I think, that in Associate Circuit Court, requiring a client to be present for a call docket generally is not the practice that is followed. So they found that to be corroborating evidence. And then in the end, what happens is Ms. Chiala, in the legal malpractice case, files a discovery request to inspect the computer, to forensically look at the computer and see when these letters were produced. The inspection is scheduled for a November date, and the day before that scheduled inspection, respondent notifies Ms. Chiala that the computer has been dumped. It's been destroyed.
How long was that after the deposition where he said he had the computer?
Deposition was taken on October 11th, 2012. He states in that deposition that he has digital files to reflect those letters. By that time, by the way, by October 11th, 2012, he's already destroyed the computer. It's gone. That had supposedly had these letters on it. And she submits a discovery request in October 12 after that deposition to inspect those computer files. And that inspection is scheduled for November 29th, 2012. And on November 28th, he notifies her that the computer has been taken to the dump. In keeping with this court's decision in Ferris, not having the documentation to prove something to us also is indicative of something that should be an adverse inference against the respondent, the fact that it didn't exist at the time that those letters were produced. Taken in its totality, based on the evidence presented to the panel found that these were fraudulently manufactured letters, found violations of 4-3.4B, submitting falsifying evidence, and 4-8.4C, conduct involving dishonesty and fraud. That, I think, frankly, is what carries this to a disbarment-type case because of that cover-up by the respondent of the conduct that was clearly negligent with regard to Ms. Mara.
Now, also, earlier on, you entered into a diversion agreement with Mr. Greer, and he was unsuccessful in that. That's in a sense, maybe, can you analogize that to maybe being like an informal suspension with conditions? And if there's evidence that he can't comply with such an informal suspension, the diversion agreement, then it's highly unlikely he's going to be able to comply with a real suspension with terms.
Well, certainly, Judge Russell, I agree with that to this extent. Respondent's asking for either a reprimand or to be placed on probation. And I think that goes right to the issue of probation. I mean, he's already violated a diversion agreement by failing to have a malpractice insurance. He didn't have malpractice insurance at the time he was being sued by Ms. Mero. And by the way, that legal malpractice case not only included respondent as a party, but also the as a defendant, the insurance company, Lidditz Insurance Company. There were multiple claims of Missouri Merchandising Practices Act against the insurance company, legal malpractice against respondent. She ends up dismissing the legal malpractice case because she gets a settlement of $72,000 from the insurance company. The testimony at the hearing was he still didn't have malpractice insurance and was pretty much judgment-proof at the time that they dismissed that legal malpractice case. They felt that there was no benefit in going forward with that. She had, because of the default judgment entered against her in the contractor's case, she ends up with her savings garnished and her savings account wiped out by the contractor who sued her for that shoddy work. So there's real damage here. And we haven't even talked about Gorodziewski, where he represents that he'll take care of a minor traffic matter and then abandons her completely. She has to hire other counsel to take care of the matter after being threatened with a suspension of her license.
Is there any mitigating evidence here?
We didn't cite any mitigation. The only thing I would cite maybe in mitigation, Judge Russell, is the fact that, he, except for the 8.4C, the fraud and misrepresentation claim, he's pretty much admitted all the violations, except for that. He doesn't admit to the fact that he fraudulently produced these letters. So I think, you know, he has at least come forward on those other violations and admitted them. In terms of aggravators, however, there's prior disciplinary offenses, a dishonest motive, pattern of misconduct, multiple offenses, vulnerability of the victim. Ms. Mara's in her 70s, a widowed, and is unable to take care of her own household activities unless someone helps her. Was unable to appear at the disciplinary hearing panel hearing for that reason. There's substantial experience in the practice of law, indifference to making restitution. He was assessed an $800 sanction by the trial court in the legal malpractice case for the destruction of the computer and has to this day failed to pay that $800 sanction. We're asking for disbarment. We think based on the evidence that came forward before the panel, there's sufficient evidence to support the fact that disbarment is the appropriate sanction in the case.
So you want disbarment, not suspension, right?
Correct. Even though at the panel, to make clear, we did submit a request for suspension based on the evidence and based on the panel's recommendation, we accede to the fact that the panel was probably correct and that disbarment is warranted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court? Thank you. My name is Brian Greer. I've been an attorney 16 years. Last time I was in this building was in October when I was getting sworn in. I'm 42 years old, I'm married, I have two children, they're 17 and 11. I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic. What I like to do for fun, I like to coach youth sports, which I coached my son's baseball team last night, and I love bowling. I probably work on average 60 to 70 hours per week. 90 to 95% of my practice is traffic and criminal defense and family law, excluding adoptions. The other 5 to 10% are civil issues like the Ms. Mara case. So I'd like to first address or at least state what I find interesting is that the complainant's brief states this is a unique case and that I'm actually admitting to several violations. When I do wrong, I have no problem coming forth saying this is what I did wrong. I have no problem admitting that. I vehemently deny that I did anything fraudulent in this case, that I created anything fraudulent, and I will get into those accusations a little bit later, excuse me. But first, to deal with the prior discipline, 2006 was when I first went out on my own. I had several issues that I had in my practice. I understood that. I entered into a diversion agreement. There were several conditions of that diversion agreement. I fulfilled every one except getting bar insurance. I applied at least four times to the bar plan to get insurance. I had 1 year to get that insurance. They kept sending the letter back saying, well, now we need this. Now we need this information. We need something else. I tried everything I could to get bar insurance. When I didn't have it within the year, that's when I failed, excuse me, that agreement. But there were other
conditions. Do you have insurance now?
I do not have insurance yet.
Have you tried anybody else? besides the VAR insurance?
I did in 2012 try again, and honestly, I'm waiting to see the result of this hearing for a large cost of insurance, but I've been basically taking cases that don't have any sort of monetary sustain.
Did you tell the OCDC that you couldn't get insurance?
Yes, I sent a letter, I think it was to Mr. Shaper Cutter, I believe is his name, that I gave him copies. I printed off copies of my application.
Who did you apply for other than the bar plan?
The bar plan was the only insurance that I applied for. Each time they kept saying they just needed one more thing. I thought once I submitted that, I was going to have insurance within a week. So that was the only condition I didn't follow. There were things, no more complaints for the year. Complete ethics classes. I went to every ethics class I was advised to go to. Solo and small firm conference, which I attend just about every year as well.
What was it that the bar plan wanted you to provide them that you said you couldn't provide?
It's hard to remember back to 2008, but I think one of them was my file on a certain case that I'd had one of the complaints on. And then it was, I can't remember honestly that far back, 8 years. But they kept sending that. And I did send to Mr. Shaper Cutter the new information each time that I would send it off to the bar plan. So with regards to the trust account issue, in 2012 for a year I was working for another attorney. I did not keep client funds in an account. I had another attorney that asked me, could you cover this case in municipal court? Here's a check. I can't make it. So what I did is I went down, covered that case, wrote the check out to the court, and I waited 2 days to put that check in my account. So I didn't have client funds. So I erred in that situation as well. I've learned that. And that's why I didn't have records, is I didn't have any records at that point working with another attorney. So in my 16 years of practice, there was 1 year in 2012 that I worked for another attorney. Now, with regards to the complaint of Ms. Gorodziewski, is she contacted me, had a simple driving while suspended case in the city of Blue Springs, gave her an amount, this is what it's gonna cost. For my representation, this is what it's gonna cost to fix. She didn't have money. What I love to do is help people. That's the one thing, and I'll get to the end where I want to be an attorney. I love helping people. There's a lot of people that I've been able to help. There's instances where I've messed up. And again, I have no problem admitting that I have messed up. But I love the practice of law. My favorite thing is people say, you're not the normal attorney. And that's what I love to hear, is I get people coming back. And that's all my business. It's word of mouth. Is the only reason I have a practice, you help somebody out, you move forward.
But did you help this person to complain?
I got them a continuance for 2 months. I let her know the new court date, how much money she needed. She did not show up to that court date. So my message back to her, she did call in. She got a letter from the Blue Springs Municipal Court saying your cases weren't handled. If they're not handled within 30 days, your license will be suspended. She called back in, and the only thing that was told to her was this is the money you needed to handle. I did wrong by not sending a letter out with a motion to withdraw with a court date. That's what I did wrong in 2012, and I've corrected that error. Any time that I have an issue again like that, it's correspondence. And that goes into the Mara case, is I was taught as a law clerk, CYA letters, you cover your tail on letters, you send out letters so that there's a paper trail.
How come the only record you have is sending her these letters to appear at hearings, including ones, docket calls and things? But there's no other, there's no contract, there's no letter saying you agreed to retain me, there's nothing telling her about judgment, there's nothing telling her about anything except various dates when she didn't really need to be there.
Exactly. With regards to the judgment, if I'm saying and lying about sending letters, why don't I lie about sending a judgment? I did not send her a judgment. I admit to that, and I admit that was malpractice. So with regards to saying she needed to be there, my reason for doing that was I wanted to see her. Again, I shouldn't have gotten involved. I should have seen the conflict that the insurance company hired the person that sued her. The insurance company then hired me, as well as I did not have in writing from the client or verbal authorization to enter her appearance. Again, that was 2008, and I have learned from that moving forward. This was 8 years ago. And What I have also learned is the reason I did enter was opposing counsel said, if you don't enter, I'm going to get a default judgment against her. And I wanted to help this lady. I was told by opposing counsel, entry, I'll be okay with a continuance. So that's why I entered my appearance for Ms. Mara that I shouldn't have, and I don't do that anymore, and I haven't been doing that anymore. And ultimately, to end on the Gorzewski matter, was she hired new counsel, never had to pay more fines, never had to get her license suspended, was in the exact same position. She didn't pay me anything. I didn't charge her for anything. I got her one continuance for a two-month period of time, and that was it. So ultimately, I didn't do anything other than a two-month continuance, and my error was not sending her that letter out.
Can you address the spoliation issue? Spoliation of evidence, the computer
okay.
that got destroyed?
Yeah, the question that I was asked, there was a deposition taken of me in the malpractice case of Mrs. Mara. And Ms. Chiala was going back and forth between my wife at the time, my current wife at the time was my secretary as well. And she kept her own files for when she would talk with people in cases that she dealt with. So she worked mainly out of our house. So she would have those. I'd have the main files at the office. I also did some work at home, but she had her own files. And in discovery, I provided absolutely everything I had, a full copy of the entire file that I had, as well as everything that was in my wife's file. And she was going back, prior to that, if you go back farther in the deposition, she was just asking about my wife's documents and what it meant on, my wife had a note that said, send letter. And she asked me what that meant. Then she comes to my six letters. When she asked about the computer, she had in her hand my wife's little summary sheet. My wife had her computer at that time. I knew exactly the question I was being asked. I did provide proof that in July I had bought a new computer. I was asked during the disciplinary hearing, don't you have proof or receipt from the dump or anything like that? And I go to the Lee Summit dump. I live in Greenwood, which is basically Lee Summit. You don't get a receipt. You pay your money. You go in and you throw a lot of stuff. I had a bunch of other stuff under my deck that I had to destroy that was old trash that had been out. So I went to the dump. My only concern in that was protecting client information. The only reason I destroyed two computers that I had since 2000 was I did not want client information being able to get out.
And you're saying your answer that you had the information digitally during your deposition was referring to your then secretary's computer had some digital information, but you weren't referring to the letters?
Correct, because she had in her hand, while she was doing the deposition, she had the summary sheet from my wife.
And the summary had what? Summary of what?
Her information. She had my wife's in the separate file that my wife kept on that. And so I saw, she goes, do you have the computer that has this information? That was what she had in her hand. And so I was answering the question that I was asked about that document. She asked about the letters previously, but then when she said this, she was holding in her hand my wife's information.
Why didn't the DHP believe you?
I can't get into their head. I don't know why they didn't believe me. I mean, that's the only thing I have here is my integrity. I think if you look at my entire career, there's nothing else in my career that's anything like this. There's not a single judge that's come forward and made any complaint about me whatsoever. I've not had an opposing counsel in a case that I've been involved with file any sort of an ethical obligation against me. I think if you look at my career, and that's the only thing I have here today to explain to you, is my word. That's all I have in this case. So I can't say why they didn't believe me. Mr. Garten of the committee, I've seen him several times in Associate Circuit Court. But he also gave an example that I don't find to be accurate. He said on these associate circuit cases like Ms. Mara's, well, don't both attorneys, they go up in front of the judge, and that's where you get your conflicts resolved through. Well, I deal a lot with Bill Hall and Independence, and you can call him up, and you don't ever even go to court on the cases unless it's set for trial, and you have an actual trial. So I think Mr. Garten didn't like that I was objecting to him saying, no, that's not how I do it. And I think Mr. Garten does plaintiff's work and I do defense work. So
Can you talk a little bit about some of the threatening of legal action against a complainant and the counterclaim that you filed against a client, the propriety of those actions by you?
Yes. What I did was around the 2011-2012, my business started going downhill a little bit, and that's ultimately why I looked for another attorney to work with, either sharing office expenses or working for someone, and I found a job that I didn't have office expenses. I was going to be working for this attorney. So this lawsuit had been filed against me, and I thought, you know, it's a public matter, which, again, if I get public reprimands, the public's going to be able to see that and decide on their own whether they still want me to help. Avvo, it's a situation that they check, and it would be a permanent record if I get probation, a suspension, or even a reprimand. But with regards to the lawsuit, was I thought that that case filing had a lot to do with my business going down. The people are checking CaseNet. CaseNet's a public record, and it wasn't necessarily a threat. It was the wrong thing for me to do. I thought that my business was being taken out. I hadn't fully really looked at it. I did wrong in the case. And prior to actually sitting down, my first instinct was just to battle. Realized that's not the right thing to do. And so I was wrong. I'm not doing that again. I have clients that owe me money. I'm not even filing lawsuits against anybody. I realized that was the wrong thing to do, and to use a lawsuit as trying to get leverage on something. So I'm not going to do that again. I've learned from my mistakes. And again, I'm far from infallible. I've made a lot of mistakes in my 42 years. So knowing that, I was fine with it being dropped. I knew that it should have been, and knew that it shouldn't have ever been filed. And so, I mean, I can't apologize anymore to Ms. Mara than what I did. But my ultimate goal in the beginning was to help her. Was told again, if you don't file an entry, I'm going to get a default judgment. I didn't want this old lady losing any money. And ultimately, she got her money put right back in her account and got a $72,000 award. I'm not saying that should look in here, but if we look at the harm that the OCDC is trying to say that I cause all these people, is let's look at where they are today versus prior to my misconduct. I'm not going to deny it was misconduct. Mrs. Gorodziewski is in the exact same situation, and Ms. Mara actually is in the same situation, if not better. And again, I love what I do. My time's ending up. I'm asking for either a reprimand or probation. I'm throwing myself at your mercy. These incidences were for 2008 and 2012. I've been working hard the last 4 to 8 years, not committing any more malpractice. If I was such a detriment to the practice of law, I think the OCDC would have gotten here a lot sooner. If there are no other questions. Okay, thank you so much.
Mr. Petzl, have there been any other complaints since this event in 2012?
I am not aware that there have been, Judge. I really can't speak to that. I haven't checked, frankly, so I'm not sure. But I don't think it's necessary to know that to come up with the result in this case, which I think is clearly appropriate. Judge Russell, I'm glad you mentioned the counterclaim because I think it's really relevant. He states that he's not a normal attorney. I don't know how many attorneys would respond to a legal malpractice case that resulted in an $8,600 judgment against the plaintiff in that case by filing a counterclaim seeking $200,000 in actual damages and $500,000 for punitive damages for defamation for the allegations contained in that legal malpractice petition, which were clearly had a qualified immunity. In the letter that accompanied that counterclaim, the respondents said to Ms. Chiala, if I'm forced to proceed in this case when someone did absolutely nothing once she was served to attempt to protect her own interests, of course she didn't know about any of the things that were coming up in that case, then I will proceed full force, and if I receive judgment, continue garnishment until judgment received in full. I will assume that if I have not received a dismissal by next Friday, your client wishes to proceed in this case. It was very vindictive. It showed a lot about his character and fitness to respond to a malpractice case, which he clearly today admitted was malpractice by counterclaiming the client who sued him.
I encourage the court to take a look at Ms. Chiala's analysis of those six letters at the appendix, at appendix pages 44 to 46, her testimony pages 59 to 67 of the DHP transcript. She gives you a letter-by-letter analysis against the actual court record of why those letters were fabricated.
He makes the point, if he was going to fabricate something, why not fabricate a letter sending along the judgment?
Well, the point is she's going to find out about the judgment because within weeks her savings account is drained. So, I mean, the fact is the one thing that he really can't lie about, the fact that this judgment was entered, she's going to find out about soon enough because her account gets garnished within weeks.
Sure, but he said if he was going to fake letters, he would have faked a letter telling her about the judgment.
I suppose. Nevertheless, I think the legal malpractice case, the letters, if you look at them, are so self-serving. Perhaps he should have fabricated a letter to her about the default judgment, but the fact is he only fabricated the letters leading up to the default judgment, in our view. He incredibly states that Ms. Mera is perhaps in a better position because she got a $72,000 settlement in the case by the contractor. That's just patently ridiculous. She had to have her savings account garnished and drained as a result of a default judgment she never knew about because of a proceeding that she had no representation in. To say that she's in a better condition than she was before all that happened is just ridiculous, and I think reflects a lot about what should happen to
the respondent. Did she bounce checks because her account was drained? Did she have a negative credit report? Did all that stuff happen?
We don't know that. I don't know that, Judge. I don't think she did not testify because of her physical condition, so I can't tell you that. But to claim that is just ridiculous. We ask for disbarment in the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.